Any other juice?
Figure it out. All right, folks. Everybody get graded exams? Or quizzes, I mean? Is there a pair? You can grab them. Pretty good on the quizzes. A couple of you took the exceptions about electron configurations to a little more of an extreme than was entirely necessary. The exceptions I showed you all involved moving just one electron, right, from one place to another place in order to even them out, and that typically only happens when we're just like one electron short of having them halfway, or one electron short of having them having it totally full, or something like that. So usually, unless there's some sort of hint in the question about it behaving similar to copper, or behaving similar to silver, or having a non-standard filling order or something like that. Unless there's some sort of hint like that, a little catch, you can pretty much assume on using the periodic table order. A lot of you forgot that when you're making a transition metal ion, you remove s electrons before you remove d electrons. You forgot about that. If you put your configuration in order of increasing n, then you just take from the n, because then the s electrons will be at the end, and you remove those first before b go away. So we have our third exam a week from today. So mostly 7 through 9, but we also have those two sections in chapter 6 with Hess's law and delta H formation values, so taking products minus reactants, that sort of stuff. So make sure you do a couple of problems on those, because there will be at least a couple of questions on the exam from those sections. Otherwise, the rest of it will be through 7 through 9. We may or may not get entirely through 9 Wednesday, so we'll see about that. The exam will only cover material that we get through on Wednesday. We definitely have a Chapter 8 assignment in Mastering Chemistry due on Wednesday night. As of now, the Chapter 9 assignment will be due on Friday of this week. You'll be able to get a good start on several of the questions after our class today. So start on that as soon as you can. We have a final exam Wednesday, December 16. You need a two-hour block for this final exam. So I'm saying here 1:30 to 3:30. If anything in there conflicts with you, if you have to be somewhere at 3 or something, let me know, and we can work out a two-hour block for you to take that exam. So check your schedules and make sure you're available for that entire time. On the webpage, in the handout section, I have a sheet in there that gives you information about this exam. It is a standardized exam, which means it comes from the American Chemical Society, and your actual grade on this is based on your performance compared with the performance of other first semester general chemistry students that have already taken the exam. Yeah. So it is comprehensive, so it goes through all of our first semester material, essentially. It is a lot of questions. It's 70 multiple choice questions in 110 minutes, which means it's less than 2 minutes per question. But there are far fewer calculation questions than there are conceptual questions on this. Okay? There are many questions which I think the majority of the questions involve you understanding how something works or why something does the way the things that it does, things that I've been trying to convey to you throughout this whole semester. So.
Are you going to give us key points to study so we don't feel
overwhelmed? Okay. So on that handout is a list of topics for you to focus on. So my starting point, I guess, would be on the previous exams. So go through those and use those as sort of a diagnostic for the things that you need to study the most. So the things you had trouble on the previous exams, I would start with that. Yeah, I just put up the exam 2 answer key, which I thought I did a long time ago, but that exam 2 answer key is up. I'll get the quizzes up right away, too. This week and next week, I'll be able to devote a good amount of time. You'll have all of your lab reports back at least by the start of finals week. So you'll be able to look through them as you're finishing up on your formal lab report. Yeah, there's a lot of questions, but they're very short questions. You know, it's not multi-part sort of thing. It's mostly one question just on one certain part of a topic. Right? Some of them are calculations, but you cannot use a programmable calculator. We've talked about that before. You can use whatever calculator you like on our exams. Right? So our third exam next week, you can use whatever you want, but the final exam must not have a programmable calculator. So get one now if you haven't yet so you can practice using it. There's $10 at Walgreens or whatever. That's the time. So there are some helpful hints and strategies that you can use in your studying as well as your exam taking to ensure that you do well on it. It is more difficult to get 90% of the questions right on the final exam than it was on ours, but you don't need 90% of the questions right to get an A. You only need like 70% of them right to get an A. So it's standardized against what the normal distribution of exam scores is for other students that have already taken this exam all across the U.S. So typically we tend to be pretty close to the nationwide average in our courses here. So students have what's that? Nope, it's the scoring formula. It's just a table that's just based on how many questions you have right. So, yeah, so it's to your advantage to answer all the questions. If you don't know it, you might as well take a guess. There are only 4 choices per question, too, so you have a little better use of elimination. Some of the questions. Anyway. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So, you know, make sure you understand those big key concepts, the big key calculations that we've done. While you may not have to do a calculation like that, you may need to know some part of it. Okay? Or, you know, you may need to compare 2 circumstances. Okay? As pressure doubles, what happens to, you know, temperature? Those kind of things, where you could do that by a big calculation, but you could save a lot of time if you just know what those relationships are. So be looking through that. Please do not save this until just the night before the final exam. I would take a look at that. I would take a look at that sheet right away and find the last third of it or whatever that will be covered on our third exam, and you can be studying for sort of both of them at the same time as you're going for our third exam. So anybody have any other questions? Well, we ended last time with our whole big ionization energy discussion, understanding that it's easier to remove an electron as we go lower down on the periodic table. Electron affinity, this is just the very last part of that, very last page of that, very last section. Electron affinity is just the opposite process. It's whatever energy changes associated with an electron being added to a neutral atom. So if I want an equation for electron affinity of lithium, what would it be? If I'm adding an electron, how would I write an equation for that? Lithium, what? Plus 1 electron makes what? Lithium minus. Right? So electron affinity always looks like that. Right. Electron affinities are usually negative, meaning we get energy out of it. if you think the ionization energies were positive because we were having to pull oppositely charged particles apart, and that requires energy to take things apart. When we toss an electron in and that electron becomes attracted to the nucleus, we get energy out of it that way. I always try to remember it like magnets. It requires effort on your part to separate two magnets from each other. If you let two magnets go, they'll cling they'll click together, they'll make a noise, they might break. Right? So that's the energy that's being released because of that. So electron affinities are typically negative. Take a look at these values here. Which one of these gives off the most energy? Yeah, fluorine becoming fluoride gives off the most energy. Lithium becoming Li minus, it gives off a little bit of energy. Okay. Oxygen becoming O minus, a little more energy. Fluorine becoming fluoride gives off twice as much energy almost, or more than twice as much than oxygen. Why does fluoride give off more energy than oxygen gaining an electron? What's special about fluorine gaining one electron? Take a look at a periodic table, maybe. Becomes the same as a noble gas, right? F minus has electron configuration the same as what noble gas? Neon? Same electrons as neon, which makes this a particularly stable ion. When I have something stable, what does that mean about its energy? Does something stable have high energy, low energy? Something that's stable has low energy. Think of it, right? You know, think of it like a vase that's teetering up high that has high potential energy, whereas a vase that's sitting down on the floor has low potential energy. Nothing's going to happen with it, and it's stable, right? So the one that makes the most stable ion will give off the most energy because this ion right here will have the lowest energy of any of these. Okay? Electron affinities are not always negative. For something that really doesn't want to have an electron, there are some of them that are positive, but we don't really typically worry about that. The most important, I guess, trend here is that when we make a noble gas electron configuration, we get extra energy back from that. Does that make sense? So we needed that because in the next chapter, we're going to specifically talk about the combination of those two. When I make a negative ion and when I make a positive ion and they bond together. So that's what chapter 9, that's part of chapter 9 anyway. Chemical bonding, we have two chapters on chemical bonding. Those are the last two chapters we'll have in this course. So this first chapter is on Lewis theory, and we'll get a nice idea of how Lewis theory works, but essentially it's the use of valence electrons that are either transferred or shared in order to have atoms that are combining together. So here's an overview of the bonding, the bonding types that we'll be talking about in this chapter. Ionic bonds typically involve a metal and a nonmetal, and we've talked about that before. If it's just two atoms, it's a metal that makes one charge, a nonmetal that makes another charge. What charge will the metal usually make when we're talking about ionic bonding? Yeah, metal usually makes the plus charge because it's easier for it to lose an electron or electrons to become stable. Nonmetals have the negative charge. We'll talk about this process in detail in a little bit, but it's electrons that are being transferred. So the metal that loses its electrons, those same electrons are gained by the nonmetal to make it negative. So the attraction that results is called an ionic bond. Covalent bonding happens when we have nonmetals that bond together. So one nonmetal atom and another nonmetal atom. So like carbon and oxygen, or carbon and carbon, for instance. Those bond together by sharing electrons. So it's not that one loses and one gains. There's sharing to some effect. There can be equal sharing and unequal sharing that we'll talk about, but still, both of the atoms retain some possession of the electrons that they had originally. So if you take a look at these sort of structures here, sodium chloride is ionic. The actual solid structure has alternating positive and negative ions stacked up in this ionic lattice structure. So whereas in a covalent compound like water, right, here's a solid covalent compound, we have individual water molecules that are all stacked up together. So we'll make sure that we know those distinctions as we're going along. Metals, pure metals themselves are kind of interesting because they don't transfer electrons, but all of their electrons are just sort of communal amongst all of the atoms. So electrons are pooled, or they call it a sea of electrons, where we have all just the metal atoms themselves all stacked up, and the electrons can flow from one side of it to another side. So that's why metals conduct electricity, because if you put in extra electrons on one side, those electrons will flow through the metal and you can get them out at the other side. That's conductivity of electricity. So the bonding that's associated is just that overall attraction between the sea of electrons and those individual metal atoms within it. All of these types of bonding, though, are governed by Coulomb's law. So the textbook gives Coulomb's law as a much more complicated constant that has to do with the atoms themselves and so on. We'll just call it K and separate out the important parts from this. So K is just a constant. These Qs are the two charges. R is a radius or a distance between the two charges. So Coulomb's law defines the energy that's associated with the attraction or repulsion of two charges. So let's start with talking about opposite charges. Okay? When we have opposite charges, one of those Qs will be positive and one will be negative. Right? Those are just actual amounts of charge measured in coulombs, or a unit like it that actually measures an actual amount of charge. So if I have two opposite charges right here, and K is a positive constant, it's just some number, what will be the sign of E when I have two opposite charges that are interacting? Yeah, E is right. Opposite charges. E is negative. So we're talking about energy that's being given off when I have opposite charges that are interacting with each other. All right. Notice R is on the denominator of this fraction. So what's going to happen to E when opposite charges are brought closer together? First of all, what happens to R when I bring two things closer together? Yeah, R gets smaller, okay? When I divide by a number that's getting smaller, what happens? The number gets larger, right? But E is negative. So which way are we going here when I bring two opposite charges closer to each other? What am I going towards? Towards zero? Towards negative infinity? Towards positive infinity? Where am I going? Yeah, potential energy becomes more negative going towards negative infinity. So I might be going from minus 100 to minus 500, okay, to minus 1,000, to minus 5,000, or something like that. Okay? So I end up giving away more energy. More energy is given off as we get closer together. And we've We've discussed that already. When opposite charges come closer together, energy is given off, right? And think of that like the two magnets coming together. The energy that's given off is the sound that you hear by them clunking together, or if they clack together so hard that they break, that energy is used in breaking those pieces apart or something like that, okay? It's a little easier, I think, to visualize when we're talking about like charges, bringing them closer together, because we all know how that happens. Whether they're both positive or both negative, what will be the sign of energy when I have two like charges? Positive, okay? He is positive. And when I bring two like charges closer towards each other, what happens to that potential energy? Increases, becomes larger towards what? Towards positive infinity, okay? Potential energy increases. It's easier to understand, towards positive infinity. So we require more and more and more energy the closer I try to bring two like charges towards each other. Does that make sense? So we're going two opposite directions. Energy is required to physically push opposite charges closer together. Energy is given off when opposite charges come towards each other, sort of on their own. Okay? We clear on that? That makes sense? So I'm going to be referring to Coulomb's law an awful lot in this chapter, but this is just really the basics of it. Okay? Two charges divided by some distance between them. Okay? The number itself gets larger as we get closer, but if it's opposite charges, it gets larger in the negative direction. If it's like charges, it gets larger in the positive direction. Okay? So just keep that in mind. All of those types of bonding we talked about are governed by Coulomb's law. So let's start with dot structures. We can use dots to show valence electrons. We determined sort of exhaustively in the last chapter where those valence electrons are. They're typically in the largest energy level, or if it's a transition metal, they're also in the largest D subshell. Okay? So these ones, we don't worry about Ds. Okay? These are just main group atoms, so it's just S and P electrons, and we use dots to show how many valence electrons they have. And since valence electrons are the important ones that will be used to make bonding, just showing those, we'll be able to have a picture of what kind of bonding happens. So we're just going straight across here. How would I draw the Lewis electron dot structure of lithium? What would I do with your periodic table? One dot. Yeah, have a periodic table out, unless you have the main group memorized.
I remember this briefly from a ago, but do you always start on this side of the element and then work?
Doesn't matter. Okay. Doesn't matter.
Right. No. I had a teacher that was very...
very particular about the direction of the dots. What I typically will do, it's sort of related to Hund's rule, but what you can sometimes do is make them individually first before you pair them on the four sides. It's sort of gives you the same thing that Hund's rule would give you, that we talked about with the ups and the downs and stuff, but even that's not tremendously important. I'm just going to concentrate on how many dots there are. So we do typically draw the two dots together because that's like 2s2, right? 2s2, 2p1, 2s2, 2p2, something like that. 2s2, 2p3, 2s2, 2p4. You can sort of do it like that. But again, whether we draw the pairs on top or the pairs on the bottom doesn't matter that much. But this is consistent with the electron configuration. If we drew the dots out, we'd have 2s2, then 2p1, 2, 3, 4, like that. So you'd have two paired and two unpaired. So again, it's not the end of the world if that's not exactly right. But So then Neon will have 8. And if we draw them in this arrangement where we do the top, bottom, and the two sides, 8 electrons fits nicely around that. So we've learned that all the noble gases have 8 valence electrons. So if we look for something that has the 8 dots around it, that's sort of a little more satisfying. It's we're not going to use this for transition metals. We're not going to try to fit 12 dots around an element. Okay, so we'll start with that. We'll use that sort of representation to draw how ionic bonds get formed. So remember, an ionic bond is an attraction of two oppositely charged ions. Coulomb's law says that two oppositely charged particles will come together and release energy in that process. So let's use those Lewis structures as a way to show the formation of ionic bonds. If I start out with just neutral sodium atom and a neutral chlorine atom, how many dots should the sodium have? One dot. Let's use a couple colors here. Let's use green for the sodium. How many dots should the chlorine have? 7? We already probably should know what's going to happen. What's going to happen here? Neither of these are stable as I've drawn them right now, but I can do one thing that will make them both stable. Am I going to share that electron?
Put them
together and put the bonds around them? Okay. Remember, I need to make an ionic bond. What has to happen for an ion to form? I have to transfer an electron. A plus ion means what had to happen? I had to lose an electron, and a minus ion means I had to gain an electron. Okay. So with that in mind, and that we're going to make an ionic bond, what has to happen here? What has to happen to this dot right there? Yeah. This one right here. That's one electron being transferred from sodium to chlorine. So sodium gets what? Oxidized or reduced? Yeah, sodium loses an electron, so it's oxidized. Chlorine gains an electron and is reduced. We end up with Na with what kind of charge? Plus. We end up with Cl with 7 of its original electrons plus that 8th electron. That it got from the sodium. What will chlorine's charge be? Negative. Typically, when I have all these dots, rather than just making a minus there and having it be confused with the dots, we'll put square brackets around that with a minus. I think the only reason for that is so that the minus doesn't get confused with the dots. We typically don't need the brackets when I have no dots, like with this sodium. We could, for Na+, draw dots corresponding to the previous shell, but to be clear, right, that this electron just transferred over there, now I'm just going to have no dots drawn in that sodium. So we just typically do it so that it's consistent with the things that we produced. So the transfer of electrons, right, it's really an oxidation reduction that happens. The metal loses an electron, the nonmetal gains electrons. We have what's called an ion pair right here. A positive and negative ion, which are attracted towards each other. So that's what causes the ionic bonding, right? That attraction of those oppositely charged ions is the ionic bond. So We do the electron transfer first, then I have oppositely charged particles which are pulled towards each other because of Coulomb's law. That's ionic bonding. So those two things, transfer of an electron, then attraction of those ions. Okay? So let's talk about the octet rule. You'll notice the noble gas we had up above had 8. This chlorine has 8 around it. Okay? That's the octet rule. When I have main group atoms, so atoms in the S block or P block, they're stable when they have 8 valence electrons. That's because noble gases have 8 valence electrons, and those, and they're sort of the benchmark of stability that we look towards. So I should not have used a colon here. Those look, I was looking at that twice, and those look like dots. Here. So it kind of equals. Anybody to be confused by that? Change that in our X version. Okay? So, sodium's electron configuration is 1s2, 2s2, 2p6. That got us over to neon. Then what? This one. If I have Na plus, that's the same as this electron configuration except for what? You drop the 3s1. If I have chlorine, that's in that next row, right? 1s2, 2s2, 2p6, 3s2, 3p5. Okay. If I have Cl minus, that's the same as neutral chlorine except what? Yeah, 3p5 becomes 3p6. In these stable ions, what is it about 8 valence electrons why is 8 valence electrons the key here, other than it's noble gas, but what in the electron configurations make 8 valence electrons in both of these? Yeah, full shells. Full what shells? What letters are full? S and P. If I have full S and full P, that adds up to 8. So there's extra particular stability that we get when S and P are full. That's where those noble gases come from. So full S and P. Right? There they are, right there. There they are, right here. Here I have started a new shell with an incomplete S and nothing in the P. Here I have incomplete P in there. So let's show you what happens when I have something like sodium and sulfur, where it's not just a one-to-one transfer of an electron. Right? Remember colors right here. Sodium, I just won, but sulfur is in group 6. Same as oxygen. So, what's the first thing that will happen when a sodium and a sulfur come near each other? What will they do? Yeah, one electron will transfer from the sodium. Right, this electron right here. I'll end up with Na plus. And I'll have S, which has 6 of its own. That's the one from the sodium. What charge will this sulfur have? Is it stable? No, it only has 7 electrons. What does that sulfur have to do in order to become stable? Has to get another electron from where? Another sodium. Okay. I need another
sodium with its one electron.
Give away that one electron, where we'll become 2 Na plus and then S,
6 of its own, 1 from the first sodium, 1 from the second sodium. Now its charge is
2 minus. What is the formula? What is the chemical formula of the ionic compound formed between sodium and sulfur?
It's Na2S.
I need a 2-to-1 ratio of sodium and sulfur because sodium can only give one electron away. Sulfur needs to gain 2 electrons. So I need twice as many sodiums as I do sulfurs. We learned originally when we were writing ionic formulas that you take their charge and you cross them over. Right? That's because something with a small charge, you need a lot of them, you need more of them in order to balance out. So this, what we have here is a neutral It's an ion pair that is neutral overall. Okay. The Na plus and S minus was neutral overall, but sulfur was not stable. Okay. In order to have something that's stable and neutral, I needed 2 sodiums per every 1 sulfur. Okay. So that's just a bit of a review from what we talked about before. We can sort of formalize that now by talking about where those electrons are, how sulfur has gained 1 electron each from each of the 2 sodiums that are nearby. Okay? Good questions with that? All right. So if we do this for real, if I take solid sodium and half an equivalent of chlorine gas, why do I have to write it this way? Why do I have to say NaS and then 1/2 Cl2? Yeah, I need essentially, if I'm forming 1 mole of sodium chloride, I need a 1/2 mole of chlorine gas because it's diatomic. We don't have individual chlorine atoms just in a jar somewhere. They're too unstable. Okay? I can have solid sodium. I can react it with chlorine gas, and this actually works. If you take solid sodium like we had in class last week and put that into a jar containing chlorine gas, it's a green-colored gas, and if you heat it up enough, you have to heat it up to get the reaction going. But once you get the reaction going, delta H is negative. What does that mean? What did we call it? What word did we have for that when delta H was negative? Exothermic, which means heat is given off. So you get it warmed up just to start it going, but then it gives off all kinds of heat. It'll glow bright red and it'll throw sparks and everything. So that is typical of the formation of ionic compounds. If I mix a metal and a nonmetal pure elements together, we'll typically get a lot of energy out, right? Exothermic. Well, we saw on the previous page that the metal gives away an electron, the nonmetal gains an electron. We had names for those processes, okay, that we just learned about. Ionization energy was removing an electron, okay, and that's positive. Why is ionization energy positive? What's happening? What about Coulomb's law? What are we doing? What are the charges here, and what's happening to those charges? And just this top one right here. Yeah, you're increasing. You have opposite charges. You're increasing the radius. Okay? So that process is difficult to do. It requires energy. This is the opposite of that. I have this electron that's being attracted to what? What's this electron actually attracted to? Yeah, Yeah, the positive protons within the nucleus of that chlorine. So that's negative because I have opposite charges approaching each other. That was Coulomb's law when we talked about the charge becomes more negative the closer they get together. It becomes more positive the further apart they come. It's just opposite. Okay? But if we look at this, if I add up these two processes, okay, if I were just in the gas phase, for instance, and I had just a single mole of electrons that were transferred, it's plus. Okay? We add up ionization energy and electron affinity, it's endothermic. So it's not just the transfer of electrons that accounts for all of this energy that's being given off. We might think it is, but it's not. It's more than that. This would be accurate if all we were doing was forming ion pairs, like we were on the previous page, if we just had that cluster of ions and then another cluster of ions. But ionic compounds are not formed that way. When we had the picture of sodium chloride, it wasn't this one little NaCl molecule and another one here and another one there. What did it look like? What do ionic compounds actually look like? Yeah, they've got all the ions all stacked up, alternating in rows and columns like that. So we're not just forming one single ion pair. We're forming this ion that's neighbored by other ions in all directions. So it's not just one Coulomb's law interaction that happens. It's that interaction that's happening in all directions, above it and below it and to each side. So all that release of energy in forming sodium chloride, it primarily comes from what's called lattice energy. It's energy associated with forming a crystalline ionic lattice from separated gaseous ions. So what we had up above would be consistent for just ions coming together just like that. Okay? Instead, we have all of these opposite ions that can all come together. Okay? And they give off much more energy because there's that attraction that's happening in all directions, not just to the left and right. So this delta H is very negative. That's that negative... it's not fully that negative number we had up above, but it's very negative. We have, think of it, instead of having just two magnets come together, a whole bag full of magnets that all come together in a big lump all at once. Okay? So that's called lattice energy. It is much more stable now than it was these individual ions. These are less stable. So high energy ions that are just alone are higher energy than when they are grouped together like that. So it's Coulomb's law that's sort of multiplied in all directions. So what we can do, I'm going to show you how that lattice energy value is actually calculated. There's no experiment that we can do to have all separated ions that all of a sudden just come together, and we can just record it in a calorimeter or something. It doesn't work that way. We have to sort of consider the different steps that might be involved, and then we can use Hess's law sort of thing. Right? If we have a series of reactions, we can sum up their energies in order to figure out what it is overall. So here is the actual reaction that happens. In order to get to this minus 410, and we can measure this minus 410 because that's an actual reaction. Okay? I can put sodium and chlorine in there. I can measure the heat that's given off when that reaction itself happens. So lattice energy is just sort of one part of this whole thing. And remember, lattice energy came from having gaseous ions. So Na plus, that's a gas, and Cl minus, that's a gas. So individual ions that are floating around. So we have to do a couple of things. We have to not only have just solid sodium, but we need to get it in the gas phase. Oops. What's the process called when I go from solid to gas? Yeah, that's sublimation. And this value can be measured or looked up in a table. That's just the heat or the enthalpy of sublimation. There are tables of enthalpies of phase changes. So I can do heat of sublimation. So now I have gas phase sodium ions. That's a value that's known, because we can take sodium and sublime it into sodium gas. Remember, for this lattice energy thing to happen, we don't just have neutral gaseous atoms. We have what? Gaseous ions. So Na gas needs to become what? Na plus in the gas phase. Turns out that's an energy change we can look up. What's that called when I have a neutral atom becoming a positive ion? What's that? Yeah, this is ionization energy, right? Because we had Na plus, or sodium becoming sodium plus an electron that's given off, right? So that is the first ionization energy of sodium. We can look that value up. So let's do the same sort of thing for chlorine. We're sort of half of the way there. We need sodium gas. Let's talk about what chlorine has to do in order to become. Yeah, this is a little different color here. What gaseous ion will chlorine have to become? Oh, John.
Does ionization energy stay constant between states?
Between states, it's only for gas phase.
Okay.
Yeah, I think ionization energy pretty much has to be gas phase. I don't think there's such thing as solid sodium ions themselves in the absence of another ion. Pretty much has to be gas phase. Talking about
mercury would have to be a gas phase.
Yeah. Yep, correct. All right, so what's the first thing that these Cl2 molecules would have to do on their way to becoming Cl minus gas? What do you think? If I have chlorine molecules, it's a pair of chlorine atoms that are bonded together. Yeah, I have to break them apart. Okay, I'm going to end up with Cl. We didn't talk an awful lot about this, but that's just called bond energy. That's the energy that's required to break the bond between two atoms. And that's really all that there is. It was already gas phase. We just had to take two atoms and separate them from each other. So there's some bond energy that's required. And then chlorine neutral to becoming Cl minus, we had a name for that. What was that called? Electron affinity. Okay. So we have these four known energies that we've already talked about. There are tables of these energies. They can be summed together. Okay. Because then I have sodium plus in the gas phase and Cl minus in the gas phase. Okay, you have these individual ions that all come together to make sodium chloride. What is this energy change known as? We had a name for that just on the very last page, having all individual ions that all come together. This is the lattice energy. Okay, so let's look at a diagram here that sort of exemplifies that, I guess, in the case of sodium and chlorine. So what will be helpful to you is for me to circle this and say this is where we start. Okay. Those are our original reactants that we said we're starting with, solid sodium and chlorine gas. can't see it very well, but those are pairs of molecules, or pairs of atoms, right? The Cl2 molecules. Okay? If I just react them together to make sodium chloride, that's the actual reaction. Okay? That's the delta H for the actual reaction that we talked about. It's a heat of formation because we're forming a mole of sodium chloride from its individual elements. Okay? So that's a value that we can measure with a calorimeter. It would probably have to be a bomb calorimeter. You can't really mix sodium and chlorine gas in a coffee cup. So I wouldn't recommend it anyway. But that value can be measured experimentally. Instead of doing it that way, we can think of all the different things that had to happen for that to go. So we had to have the sublimation, right? That requires energy, right? because I'm going from solid atoms that are slow to gaseous atoms that are flying around. It takes energy to do that. Okay? It takes energy to break a covalent bond, just because of Coulomb's law. I'm pulling two things apart. That requires energy to do that. Okay? I will ionize the gaseous sodium. That takes energy because I'm pulling an electron away from sodium. I will add an electron to gaseous chlorine. We get energy back from that because I have an electron that's being attracted to a nucleus. Okay? Get an electron back from that. And then we get all of this energy that's given off, okay, because this is the lattice energy. Okay? So it's not really the energy that's given off from the electron transfer. It's all of those ions coming together in order to give all that energy away. So almost all of these, we can use Coulomb's law to predict their sign, at least. If I'm separating things apart, separating opposite charges apart, that requires energy. If I'm putting opposite charges closer together, we get back energy from that. Okay. Just the electron transfer was these two steps, so that's not enough to explain why we get back energy overall. Okay. So this is just sort of a picture representation of Hess's law when we added reactions together. So if one step is exothermic and another is exothermic and then one is endothermic, those all combine together to make the overall energy change for the reaction. So this is the overall right here, that energy change. Overall, energy is given off when that's formed. But that's because we had to add energy in to make sodium gas, add energy in to make chlorine atoms, add energy in to make sodium plus. We got a little back by making Cl minus, but then we got a lot back by combining all of those opposite ions together in the ionic lattice. Okay? Does that make sense? Yes? Now, the book, I think, might have a couple of calculations. You are not required to do any calculations for this on the exam, anyway. But I do need you to be familiar with this process, okay? Understanding that that there's sublimation, there's bond breaking, there's ionization energy and electron affinity that have opposite signs, understanding that most of the energy that's given off comes from those opposite ions coming into contact with each other, and that's called lattice energy. Okay? So be able to answer maybe some questions about this, but I don't need you to go through the whole calculation. But we would be able to calculate this lattice energy if I knew all of these blue values. That's how we can get values for the lattice energy of substances. Mm-hmm. Yep. For any ionic compound that's forming, the majority of the energy that's produced or given away comes from those ions themselves coming together. Yep. So lattice energy is a calculated value that we get by adding up all of these things in order to just get that one number there. It's a Hess's law sort of problem. We could rearrange all of these things in order to get this as our overall reaction if we wanted to. But it would end up being a minus of that, a plus of that, plus of that, plus of that, minus of that. And it would give us this value. Okay? Any questions? All right. Well, since we have values of lattice energy that can be calculated, there are periodic trends in lattice energy. Because we're dealing now with two atoms, right? Two ions that are it's not just two that are coming together, but two elements that are making this ionic compound, and multiple of them that are coming together. We have to sort of consider how both of those elements happen, or what's easiest is if it's a periodic property, have one of them be the same and change the other one. Okay, so here's lattice energy for lithium chloride, okay, minus 834. So let's consider, here are these atoms. Remember, as we're going down a column, our periodic properties always depend on adding additional shells in. Okay? So use Coulomb's law here. Which of these will be the strongest ionic bond? Think about it. The only difference of those is how separated the ions are. What's that? Hit louder. Lithium chloride. That's the shortest atomic radius, right? The shortest distance between the two nuclei. We have a negative lattice energy. Remember, lattice energy is negative because we're putting those oppositely charged particles together. Okay? That's the shortest bond. We will get a large amount of energy out by bringing two charges very close to each other. Okay? If I have sodium chloride, potassium, cesium, I'm bringing ions together, but they're not getting as close to each other. So what do you suppose the trend will be for numbers for here? So towards zero, towards negative infinity? What do you think? We're going to go towards zero. We're going to get less energy back because those ions aren't able to get as close to each other. So I'll give you these values. Minus 787, minus 701, minus 657. Okay? We get less energy out because ions are not as close together. So in that cycle we had on that last page, lattice energy was the big drop down. If I have larger ions, I'll have less of a drop down. There'll be less energy given out. So overall, it'll tend to be a little less exothermic overall in the reaction. Okay? So ion size is an important consideration because that ends up being what term in Coulomb's law? What part of Coulomb's law is determined by this, what we did just right here? R, the radius, the distance between the two charges. Okay? The other part of Coulomb's law was the actual magnitude of those charges. Okay? Is it a little bit of minus or a lot of minus, a little bit of plus? Right? So that can be determined by the charge of the ions themselves. So I have two compounds here, sodium fluoride and calcium oxide. What are the two ions in sodium fluoride? What are their charges? Sodium makes a plus charge. Fluoride makes a minus. What about in calcium oxide? What are those ions? All right. 2 plus and 2 minus. So in Coulomb's law, those q values, they're up on top of the fraction. So if I have a larger amount of charge, how much more charge do I have on the bottom than on the top? Twice? How much? If I have 1 and 1 and then 2 and 2, that's not twice as much overall. That's the magnitude of those charges. If I'm right, multiplying, right,
Q1 times Q2. So the actual charge will be proportional to these numbers. So plus 1 times minus 1 plus 2 times minus 2.
So what's plus 1 times minus 1? Minus 1. What's plus 2 times minus 2? Minus 4. Okay? So this one has 4 times the charge. So going from singly charged ions to 2 plus ions will be a 4-fold increase according to Coulomb's law. So any predictions about what the lattice energy will be for calcium oxide? Radius will be pretty similar because they're in the same row as each other. Okay. Should be 4 times as much.
It's pretty close. It's minus
3414. Okay. So the difference comes because the radius, right, the radii are not exactly the same. There's a little bit off. Plus those constants are a little bit different for other things. We're not just talking about point charges that are coming to within a certain distance. There's other things. But it gives us a pretty good estimation. So we get a lot more energy back by bringing 2 plus and 2 minus charges in contact with each other than we do 1 plus and 1 minus. Okay. In fact, there's Coulomb's law right there that shows just right there. 2 times 2 gives us 4 times as much charge on the top there. All right. Before we predict melting point there, I'll have you guys at least predict and get an idea of where the melting point has gone. Let's complete this sentence here, see if we can figure it out. As the lattice energy becomes more negative, that's what happens here, that was ions coming together that gave away a whole bunch of energy. The ions become more what to separate? They become more easy to separate or more difficult to separate? Go in the other direction. Yeah, they become more difficult, right? I've got 4 times as much charge. That's like having bigger magnets there that are harder to pull apart. So they become more difficult to separate. When I melt a compound like this, I have to separate the ions. Right? We don't think too much about melting ionic compounds, but you can do it. Okay? Sodium fluoride, sodium chloride, things like that have melting points that are close to 1,000, so you have to heat it in a ceramic crucible with a flame, but you can get a molten ionic compound. So if the ions are more difficult to separate, will the melting point be lower? Higher? Melting point will be higher. And melting point increases. Okay? So, prediction. Melting point greater than 993 or less than 993? Greater than, much greater than. Okay. It's not 4 times, but then again, this is degrees Celsius. I wonder if we put that in Kelvin, if it would be closer to 4 times. Well, that's a little something to think about, I suppose. All right, let's look at our two effects, our two things that affected lattice energy. So the energy that we get by combining ions together. What's a more important effect, ion size or ion charge?
Charge.
Yeah. It's a huger effect going over to a different column in the periodic table than it is going down. Okay? We get incremental size increases, and that's just a single thing on the bottom of Coulomb's law. But by having 2 plus ion, right, as opposed to having the 1 plus ion, we actually get 4 times the charge. And if I had 3 pluses and 3 minuses, that would be 9 times the charge. Okay? So ion charge is a larger effect. Okay. So, if we know that, if we know the trends in either direction, and we know which direction is dominant, we can actually rank 4 elements that are sort of in a square on the periodic table. So, let me bring up a periodic table. I'll devise a little question for us. Let's just do these 4. Okay? Have those attached to either oxides or fluorides. So let's go back. Sodium, magnesium, potassium, and calcium. Grid. There you go. So let's have either oxides or fluorides. So fluorides here, oxides there. Okay. So our negative ion size is not different between those. The only thing I'm changing is the positive ion, okay? Making a slightly larger positive ion, going down here, increasing the charge as I go over that way. Okay? So size-wise, what can we say about this? What is the periodic property for size? Okay? For distance between the ions. That'll give us half of this problem.
Radius?
Yeah, radius. Which of these, what can radius tell us? How far they're apart? Yeah. What can radius tell us about the ionization energy of some of these? Stronger than others? Which ones? Yeah. Let's look back at what we said up on top here. Lattice energy decreased going down a column. Right? The ions themselves get further away, so it's not as strong as of an ionic bond. Okay? So which pair of these will be which pair of these will have a less strong attraction than the others just because of their size?
Potassium.
Yeah, potassium and calcium. Okay. A slightly larger radius. Okay. So let's call number 1 the most negative, and number 4 the least negative in terms of lattice energy. Okay. So those ones on the bottom, will they be more negative or will they be less negative than the ones on the top? Yeah, they'll be less negative. Okay. So size lets us tell between the bottom row and the top row. Okay. What's the other thing we look at? Charge. Okay. The left column and the right column. What'll be the difference between those? Mm-hmm, yeah. Single charges versus 2 plus 2 minus charges. Okay, so going this way, more charge. Okay. That column. Okay. So what'll be negative? What'll be more negative? The left column or the right column? Left. Look at that relationship. A larger magnitude of charges means those ions come crashing at each other much more strongly. Okay? So try to pick out the one of those four that you think has the most negative number. Don't say it out loud. And in your head, then see if your neighbors agree with you. Whisper it to your neighbor. See if you agree. I want the one that's most negative. All right. It works for sodium fluoride? Potassium fluoride? Pretty much eliminated these ones because we knew the 2 plus 2 minus charges gave us more energy back. Okay? Magnesium oxide? Some votes for that. Calcium oxide? Some votes for that. Well, the difference, larger radius. Okay? Which one gives us back more energy? Larger radius or smaller radius? Smaller radius gives us back more energy because the two opposite charges come closer to each other. Okay? So Coulomb's law says charges getting closer give us more energy back. Okay? So what's number one then? Yeah, magnesium oxide is number one. It's a different color. Okay. What's number two? Sodium fluoride or potassium oxide? Or calcium oxide, sorry.
Calcium.
Yeah. This one's number two because what tells you that this one is number two and not that one?
Still has
the larger charge. And I told you that that is a larger effect than just the, let's not say the lattice energy, than atomic radius. And ion size. Okay. Got ion charge and ion size. The charge is the bigger effect because I'm multiplying the two charges. Okay. 2 plus 2 minus is 4 times the charge. Okay. So 1, then 2. What's going to be number 3 then? Sodium fluoride, then potassium fluoride. Okay. So the one that will get the most energy out of, the one with the biggest bang when the ions come together, is the ones that have big charges and small ions. Right? So that's the most favorable for Coulomb's law. Just write that here. The most energy given away are big charges, small okay. All right. So when you're looking for large energy given away, large negative lattice energy, okay, having larger charges, okay, having small ions because they can get close to each other. Okay. Out of time? Yep, out of time.